that they're morally superior, and that these countries, oh, they're ruled by dictators, and they mismanaged their economies, and they caused all this. But these Western powers, they know precisely that the sanctions they inflict on others are ineffective and will ruin lives and kill civilians overseas. And they choose to do it anyway. And then they have the nerve to accuse the governments they're targeting for regime change of being responsible. This is their way of shirking responsibility and keeping this narrative going of, oh, look how brutal this regime is, we need to go and get rid of them. That's what gangsters and criminals do when they don't get their way and they can't profit off of someone else. They punish, they hurt, they lie, they kill, they steal. That's what the United States, the United Kingdom, and their allies do. They inflict immeasurable suffering on millions of people, on millions of civilians all over the world who've done nothing wrong. Whatever they accuse Chavez, Maduro, al-Assad of doing, it pales in comparison to the barbarous and cold-blooded siege warfare that they impose on the people of Venezuela, Syria, Iran, Cuba, Yemen, and others. The United States and their allies think that they can use sanctions to intimidate Venezuela, intimidate Syria, intimidate Iran and others. They think that bullying and stealing and starving us is going to work. But they are sorely mistaken. All they have done is increase the resilience and strengthen the resolve of the oppressed. The people of Venezuela, they're not going anywhere. The people of Syria, they will not be intimidated. The people of Iran, Cuba, Yemen, and the global south will never bend the knee to imperialist bullies and war criminals. Solidarity to all. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
Around the world with reporters.
For the past 15 years, these shanties have been the new homes of Rohingya refugees, a scattered community dwelling here with no proper sanitation facilities and unhygienic conditions. To them, what matters is to survive, and that's all they've been trying to get. Escaping persecution at the hands of authorities in Myanmar, the Muslim Rohingya community has been fleeing their homes for safer locations. But decades have passed and they still have no place to call home.
A decade ago, we left Rakhine because they were mercilessly killing people from our community. Our women were raped and children were taken into forced labor. For the sake of life and honor, we moved out of bloody place, but our ill fate loomed over us everywhere. We are being forced out of everywhere.
New Delhi's recent crackdown on illegal immigrants in the Jammu region landed over 160 Rohingya refugees in detention centers, which has forced others to flee the makeshift camp. The refugees are now heading to unknown locations.
This time, the authorities have rejected our UNHCR cards. They have taken our men and we are left helpless. The silence of the global Muslim community towards our plight has made our lives miserable.
Since the Hindu nationalist Bharatiya Janata Party came to power in India, minorities in the country are feeling the heat. The BJP introduced the Citizenship Amendment Bill in 2019. It grants Indian citizenship to Hindus, Christians, Buddhists, Sikhs and other minorities who fled neighboring countries like Pakistan, Bangladesh and Afghanistan before 2014, fearing religious persecution. However, the Citizenship Amendment Act discriminates against Muslims and violates the rights of equality enshrined in the Constitution of India. In the state of Assam, illegal immigrants from Bangladesh have long been a source of concern for India. Accordingly, around 2 million residents were left off the National Citizenship Register, a majority of them Muslims. The register is a list of people who can prove they had entered India by March 1971, right before neighboring Bangladesh became an independent country.
Analysts say the Hindu nationalist Bharatiya Janata Party aims at transforming India into a majoritarian community by granting citizenship rights to majority groups. And all this has dented India's democratic image globally and has downgraded India from a democracy to an electoral autocracy. Shahana Butt, Indian Administered Kashmir.
The first high-level meeting between the U.S. and China under Joe Biden's presidency gets off to a frosty start. putting the deeply strained relations between the two countries on public display. The opening session of a two-day meeting in Alaska saw top American and Chinese officials hurling accusations at each other in front of the world media. During the meeting, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken accused China of threatening the global stability, conducting cyber attacks against the U.S., and practicing economic coercion. He also lashed out at Beijing for what he called committing human rights violations, including in Hong Kong. Senior Chinese diplomat Yang Jiechi reacted by calling the U.S. allegations hypocritical. He noted that Washington's own human rights records are at a low point, especially with regard to its treatment of African Americans who are being, quote, slaughtered there. Yang also accused Washington of using its military might and financial power to suppress other countries. The senior Chinese official said Washington, with its unfounded allegations, is trying to obstruct normal trade exchanges and inciting some countries to attack China. The two top economies have been at loggerheads for years over a host of issues, including trade, cybersecurity, Taiwan, and Hong Kong. The U.S. has also been on the forefront over China's maritime dispute with some of its neighbors over the South China Sea, siding with Beijing's rivals and routinely dispatching warships and warplanes to the region. Experts believe the U.S. is increasingly concerned about China's growing economic power.
The United States is increasingly concerned about China's growing economic power. Now, China has an economy that's roughly half the size of that of the United States, but China has been making gains on the United States, as we know, in recent years.
The Sino-American relations sank to their lowest level under former President Donald Trump, who initiated a trade war with China using tariffs as a pressure tool. The Biden administration has taken a somber approach as it views the Sino-American relations as the biggest geopolitical test of the 21st century. However, it has so far refrained from rolling back Trump's policies to mend bilateral relations. It appears Biden is following in Trump's footsteps not only with regard to China, but other global issues. 2 months after his inauguration, Biden has also failed to live up to his campaign promise of returning to the UN-endorsed 2015 Iran nuclear deal that was signed during his vice presidency but abandoned by Trump in 2018. Iran says Biden is no different from his predecessor when it comes to honoring the accord. Tensions have also escalated between Moscow and Washington in recent days, with Russia warning that bilateral ties are, quote, on the brink of collapse, that after the U.S. president called his Russian counterpart a killer and warned that Vladimir Putin will pay the price for what he claimed meddling in the U.S. presidential election.
Belgium's largest COVID-19 vaccination center, located in Hazel on the outskirts of Brussels City. Like hundreds of similar venues across the EU, officials here are worried about vaccine supply. 33-year-old nurse Alex Gavoni has arrived to get the jab.
I have a vaccination center behind my house, but I could not go there because they don't have enough supplies. And this place is a bit far away from me, for the other people that have to come. And as a nurse, I'm a bit concerned that the people will not take the vaccine because of the confusion with AstraZeneca for the moment.
AstraZeneca is contracted to supply the EU with 90 million doses before the end of this month, but will only deliver 30 million. The firm is supposed to supply 180 million doses in April, May and June, but says it will only provide 70 million.
AstraZeneca has underproduced and under-delivered.
Key EU member states will start to administer AstraZeneca again after being reassured by health authorities amid safety concerns.
This is a safe and effective vaccine.
Experts are asking, due to the EU's dismal handling of the affair, how many people will be willing to take the jab. In any case, the German government says there are not enough vaccines in the EU to prevent a third wave. For example, infection rates are again out of control in France and Italy. Health officials say the UK variant of the virus is wreaking havoc in Poland. Many hospitals are reaching breaking point. Health experts warn that when centres are not being fully utilised, COVID-19 mutations are allowed to develop in the community. The big concern is future variants might be even more contagious and more deadly. Jerome Hughes, Brussels. We'll be right back.
Scotland's First Minister, Nicola Sturgeon, is fighting for her political life. An inquiry into her handling of the sexual harassment charges brought against her predecessor, Alex Salmond, is underway. Salmond and Sturgeon have both given evidence, but a leaked draft report has revealed committee members have voted 5-4 that Sturgeon gave them an inaccurate account of what happened. However, she says she stands by every word.
I think the first thing to say is I stand by all of the evidence I gave to the committee, all 8 hours worth of evidence. I mean, what's been clear is the opposition members of this committee made their minds up about me before I uttered a single word of evidence. Their public comments have made that clear. So this leak from the committee, very partisan leak tonight, before they've actually finalised the report, is not that surprising. So let's wait and see the final report. But more importantly, the question of whether or not I breached the ministerial code is being considered independently by James Hamilton QC, and I hope and expect to receive and publish that report soon.
If that inquiry also finds against her, she is not legally compelled to resign, but she'll be under a lot of pressure to do so. A recent poll shows her party have a 22-point lead, so she may well remain First Minister after the May elections. What's certain is Sturgeon isn't going down without a fight. In the evidence she gave earlier this month, she defended her position, accused Salmond of inappropriate behaviour, and apologised directly to the two women that were let down by the government investigation.
A number of women made serious complaints about Alex Salmond's behaviour. The government, despite the mistake it undoubtedly made, tried to do the right thing. As First Minister, I refused to follow the age-old pattern of allowing a powerful man to use his status and connections to get what he wants.
Alex Salmond was cleared of all charges and compensated for his legal fees, but now Sturgeon is on the ropes. Many are questioning why a new policy on sexual harassment, inspired by the Me Too movement, could be used to bring down the First Minister, a woman herself and one of the most successful politicians of a generation. Analysts say one reason might be that she is also the figurehead of Scotland's independence campaigners. Bianca Rahimi, London.
Representatives of the Afghan government, influential political leaders, the Taliban and some key regional and international players have decided to continue negotiations on the fate of the Afghan peace trend in Moscow. There are two main scenarios on the negotiating table at the Moscow summit in order to bring peace to war-ravaged Afghanistan.
The first scenario for the transition of power from President Ashraf Ghani is to establish a transitional government. This scenario has so far been backed by some players, including Russia, the US, Pakistan, and China.
However, experts here believe the second scenario that will most probably gain support from Iran and India follows another solution, which is holding an early election for the transition of power. This comes while war-weary Afghans say, as their country has entered a very different phase of its history, it's too important for influential political leaders to make a united front and convince all players to just put an end to war at any cost.
Our country is bleeding and it needs help from all those who are involved in the Afghanistan crisis. But we want our own leaders to set aside their differences and lead the country to lasting peace.
Locals here also call on the Taliban to respect people's demand and honestly work on a true peace plan if they are not serving foreign players.
The Taliban needs to realize that there are no military solutions to the crisis, so it should say no to foreign demands that are against Afghanistan's national interests and closely work with others to bring calm and stability to Afghanistan.
Let's not forget that the Afghan government had already rejected Russia's agenda regarding the Afghan peace process, and now another summit is slated to be held in Turkey in 2 weeks. The Turkey conference will also work on the Afghan peace process, but only time will tell whether those meetings can lead the country to peace and stability. Sayed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Helpless parents in this protest held in Pakistan's capital Islamabad. They have a tragic story which they say no one is willing to listen in Pakistan. Their two sons, one after the other, disappeared. One of them disappeared 7 years ago, while the another one just last week. They have no clue about the whereabouts of their sons.
If my sons are found guilty, the government must punish them. But if not, then must set them free. But no one in the government listens to us. We don't know what to do.
This is just tip of the iceberg of the tragedy of the victims of thousands of similar cases of enforced disappearances. It all started in late 2001 when the US-led NATO forces invaded neighboring Afghanistan and Islamabad joined their so-called war on terror. Pakistan's secret services have been at the heart of allegations to have illegally detained citizens under the cover of so-called war on terror. A significant number among the detained citizens were allegedly secretly handed over to the US. The repeated demands of the victim families to either prosecute their loved ones or set them free have gone unheard in Pakistan. Despite promises to set them free, the successive civilian governments and judiciary have done little to help the victim families. The country's military-run secret services have mostly defied the orders of Pakistan's penal courts to release the missing citizens, languishing in jail for years, some of them well over a decade, without any charge sheet.
There's no power with the politicians. There's no power with the in the democracy in Pakistan. They cannot ask them. There's no accountability of the intelligence agencies for doing illegal activities. They are out of the ambit of law. They can do anything. Any army person, any uniformed person can just blame anybody and that person will be disappeared. That person will be in jail.
In a controversial move, Pakistan's parliament provided blanket immunity to the secret services in 2014 from prosecution on the charges of illegal detention, torture, and killing of citizens. Nonetheless, this did not bring any significant let-up in enforced disappearances in Pakistan. Javed Rana, Islamabad.
An amnesty bill for Catalonia's jailed leaders was put before Spain's Congress of Deputies on Tuesday to end the political crisis in the northeastern region. The bill was filed by lawmakers from the four Catalan pro-independence parties with the support of Òmnium Cultural, a grassroots organization whose leader was found guilty of sedition in the 2017 referendum trial and sentenced to 9 years in jail.
We brought forward the amnesty law as a starting point for a democratic solution. If the government really believes that the repression exerted in Catalonia was a mistake, it should adopt the amnesty law as a way to correct that mistake.
Spain's ruling Socialist Party had dismissed the amnesty bill even before it reached Congress.
We have always expressed opposition against amnesty. We're always willing to accept particular cases and in accordance with the legal framework. But we have never opted for such an amnesty that undoubtedly has much more political character of acquittal.
The socialists say they favor other solutions to amnesty, namely a presidential pardon or a reform of the sedition law that sentenced the jailed Catalan leaders to up to 13 years behind bars. For the separatists, neither of these proposals addresses the hundreds of independence-related legal cases they claim are pending trial in Spain's courts.
With the amnesty bill doomed to fail from the outset, the fate of jailed leaders now goes down the path of either clemency or the reform of Spain's criminal code. A slow and winding path that even the most optimistic in Catalonia say it will lead nowhere. Cusay Kadri, Barcelona.
The second Tehran Dialogue Forum was held virtually, but the messages were as strong as last year's. Foreign ministers of Iran, Turkey, and Afghanistan discussed the latest major issues in the Middle East, from terrorism to the U.S. destabilizing presence in the region. Iranian Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif made the opening speech, where he touched on the U.S. intervention in the region, saying Washington has spent billions of dollars on its military sector only to perpetuate insecurity in the region.
The U.S. has exacerbated the insecurity and instability of this region more than any other region. As its own figures suggest, some $7 trillion have been wasted on forever wars and military interventions in this region.
Zarif also censured the U.S. for keeping its anti-Iran sanctions amid the pandemic, calling the measures an economic war waged against the Iranian people.
U.S. coercive economic measures directed against the Iranian people, especially at a time of pandemic, are nothing less than economic warfare. And as we now witness, there has been yet no difference in following a failed policy of the so-called maximum pressure between the former and the current U.S. president.
Echoing Zarif's remarks, Turkish Foreign Minister Mevlut Cavusoglu also rejected the unilateral U.S. sanctions against Iran, saying Ankara supports a U.S. return to the 2015 Iran nuclear deal and its full implementation.
From the very beginning, we have stood alongside Iran against unilateral sanctions. And Turkey has always supported the full implementation of the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. Now we support the new U.S. administration's declared intention to return to the deal. And we are hopeful that a mutually acceptable formula will be found to revive the JCPOA.
Afghan Foreign Minister Hanif Atmar was another diplomat at the virtual meeting who said his country should not become a safe haven for terrorists.
It's important for the region and for the outside world to realize the fact that outside problems should not be fought over on Afghan soil.
Tehran Dialogue Forum held its first edition last year with the presence of senior officials and heads of research institutes from different countries. The aim is to discuss views on major developments in sensitive areas, including the Persian Gulf and West Asia. It seems that the trilateral meeting boils down to a single message. Three major countries in the region, Iran, Turkey, and Afghanistan, believe that it's time for the U.S. to stop its problematic behavior in West Asia. They say it can start by leaving the region and its people alone. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
As its own figures suggest, some $7 trillion have been wasted on forever wars and military interventions in this region.
The top Iranian diplomat underlined that the U.S. interventions are aimed at dominating the region. He said the region has turned into a military zone for the U.S. and its allies through their troop presence and arms sales to certain states. Addressing the Tehran Dialogue Forum, Syria's Foreign Minister Faisal Miqdad highlighted the U.S. occupation of his country. He said that Washington formed a coalition under the pretext of fighting terrorism, but its main agenda was to attack Syria and threaten other regional countries.
The United States and the European Union, or the leading countries in the European Union, are using this coalition to attack Syria, to threaten other independent countries in the region, and to claim that they are fighting against Daesh. Daesh, in fact, has been encouraged and supported by the United States.
Years of devastation in Syria caused by the U.S. and its allies with their backing to terror groups are just the tip of the iceberg. U.S. interventionist agenda in other countries such as Iraq, Afghanistan, Yemen, and Libya all show that Washington wants to destabilize West Asia to dominate it. However, such stance has simply ignited anti-U.S. sentiment across many countries. In Iraq, protests against the presence of American troops and a parliamentary resolution for the expulsion of all U.S. troops last year are part of the sentiment. Calls grew louder after the U.S. assassination of top Iranian General Qasem Soleimani and Iraqi commander Abu Mahdi al-Mohandes in a drone attack in January last year. The U.S. too has come to a conclusion that its West Asia policies have been a complete failure. Last week, the U.S. government, for the first time, acknowledged that the Yemen war has no military solution. Secretary of State Anthony Blinken also told UN Special Envoy for Yemen, Martin Griffiths, that diplomatic efforts should be redoubled with the help of the UN and other players to end the Yemen war. But shouldn't Washington be blamed for the Yemen carnage, as it's been the main supplier of arms to Saudi Arabia and its allies that invaded the impoverished nation? But the U.S. views the West Asia region as a military zone, and what matters to Washington most is making profit out of chaos and conflicts, for it can sell more weapons to the rich Arab states.
Happy Nowruz celebration of New Iranian calendar year to all Iranians and all Farsi-speaking people around the world. I, on behalf of IRIB English Radio staff, congratulate you the beginning of spring. Ramped-up sequencing efforts are helping to identify mutations that might boost transmission or help a virus evade immune responses, says Ewan Calloway, author, in an article published under the heading Multitude of Coronavirus Variants Found in U.S., but Threat is Unclear. Stay tuned, please. For the scientists who have spent the past year poring over hundreds of thousands of coronavirus genomes, the United States has been an enigma. Despite having world-leading genome sequencing infrastructure and experiencing more COVID infections than any other country, the United States has until recently lagged far behind in sequencing coronavirus genomes and spotting worrisome variants. But in recent weeks, U.S. researchers have identified a host of new variants, including in California, New York State, Louisiana, and elsewhere. And they are continuing to ramp up SARS-CoV-2 sequencing efforts. That has brought another challenge: making sense of the variants that are discovered. They carry potentially worrying mutations and might be becoming more common, but a dearth of data on how the variants are spreading means the threat they pose is unclear. It's the Wild West, says Jeremy Camille, a virologist at University of Louisiana, who co-led a team that last month spotted a fast-rising variant in Louisiana, New Mexico, and elsewhere. In the absence of clear data on a variant's behavior, it's as if there is an unofficial policy that every variant is a variant of concern until proven otherwise, says Camille. Part of the challenge is the decentralized nature of U.S. coronavirus sequencing and surveillance efforts. Right now, it's individual labs or states or cities doing their part, says David Ho, a virologist at Columbia University in New York City, whose team last week identified a variant in the city with a mutation that could compromise immune responses. As a result of this, piecemeal effort, states such as New York, California, and Washington have contributed thousands of sequences each, while others, such as Iowa, Tennessee, and New Hampshire, have obtained sequences from far fewer of their COVID cases. Other U.S. researchers took enviously at the United Kingdom, where a nationwide sequencing effort, which works closely with public health, medical, and research institutions to make sense of variants, has generated more than 300,000 coronavirus genomes. Thanks to the fine granularity of its data, the UK effort showed in late 2020 that the variant called B117 clearly spread faster than the circulating strains it would go on to displace. Subsequent research has suggested that B117 might be deadlier, but does not compromise vaccines. "I don't think we have anything like that," says Ho. He hopes that the U.S. National Institute of Health and the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, CDC, the federal agencies responsible for biomedical research and public health, will get the country moving in a more concerted fashion. A CDC-led effort launched in November is aiming to sequence around 7,000 samples per week, a goal met for the first time in late February at eventually 25,000. In the absence of clear-cut epidemiological or medical data, scientists can gauge some of a variant's potential threat by the mutations it carries. Researchers have drawn up a growing list of mutations that might boost transmission or help a virus evade immune responses, based on lab or epidemiological studies. The variant that Ho's team identified in New York, also known as B1-526, carries a notorious mutation called E484K that has been found in variants identified in South Africa and Brazil. Studies by multiple labs have shown that E484K change, which is in a portion of the coronavirus spike protein that recognizes host cells, weakens the potency of antibodies that can ordinarily disable the virus. That could help explain observations that similar variants in South Africa and Brazil are behind cases of reinfection and reduced vaccine efficacy in field trials. On the basis of those concerns, a team led by Ho and Columbia University microbiologist Anne Catherine Olleman set up a surveillance network to identify viruses carrying E484K in New York City. The first cases of the B1-526 variant appeared in November, growing to 5% of the city's total cases in mid-January and 12% by February. In public sequencing databases, the researchers found B1-526 up and down the northeast coast of the U.S. and as far away as Singapore. The notoriety of E484K also inspired a team led by Pamela Bjorkam and Anthony West, structural biologists at the California Institute of Technology in Pasadena, to trawl through public sequencing data where they spotted a lineage emerging in New York. Ho concedes that B1-526 needs much more study. It has not yet been shown to dodge immune responses, and its apparent rise in frequency may be unrelated to any biological property. It's taken months for the UK variant B.1.1.7 to be shown to be more transmissible and more virulent. I think we would need to do the same, he says. While researchers try to make sense of newly discovered US variants, redoubled sequencing efforts are also turning up more cases linked to global variants of concern. So far, researchers in the US have uncovered only a handful of cases linked to immune-evading variants identified in South Africa and Brazil. But cases of the B.1.1.7 variant identified in the United Kingdom are rising steadily, a pattern repeated in other countries in Europe and the West Asia region. Which of these variants will predominate in anyone's guess, say researchers? But as vaccination ramps up, susceptible variants such as B.1.1.7 could dwindle, while those that can partly evade immunity might spark regional flare-ups. I don't think we are going to have years of New York variants and California variants, says Barrett. Figuring out what is happening will depend not only on sequencing more samples, but also on building the capacity to understand them. The US must do a better job along these lines, says Ho.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran, for big and small. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Salaam alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. You're listening to the program of Islamic Upbringing. In this program, we discuss problems and questions parents have regarding the Islamic upbringing of their children. The answers are mostly based upon the book, Children in the Quran and Sunnah, compiled by Ayatollah Ray Shahri. We have in the studio our guest speaker, Brother Miqdad. He's an Islamic researcher in the Hawza Ilmiya of Qum. Salaamu alaikum, Brother Miqdad. How are you?
Alaikum salam wa rahmatullah. Thank you.
Brother Miqdad, one of our listeners has a question. He asks that, I enrolled my two boys to gymnastics a few months ago, and they were doing really well. But all of a sudden, they lost all motivation for it. I don't think anything specific happened, but they just don't want to go anymore. My children are 7 and 5. What do you advise me to do? So, Brother Mullah, what do you think about this question? So, what could have happened? Like, all of a sudden, they lost interest in going to gymnastics. What do you advise the mother to do?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. So this is an interesting question. First of all, let me mention that sports for children is very important, and definitely encourage all parents to, as much as they can, involve children in different activities and different sports.
Yeah, that's right.
And gymnastics is one of those really good sports because it's something that involves a lot of skill. It requires paying attention to mm-hmm. the entire body.
Yeah.
It's got some level of discipline. It's a good sport, especially at this young age when you're, when your children are 5, 6, 7, 8. I would even say even before they start playing football, or even if you have to choose between the two, even sometimes it's better to do gymnastics than football. It's got gives more strength to the body.
It's really good for one's body.
Definitely, and for as a long-term thing as well, it's less injury-prone as well. Mm-hmm. So this is definitely a very good thing that this parent is doing by sending her children to gymnastics.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when children try new activities or get involved in new sports, etc., there's a few motivational factors that is prevalent there. Usually the most common one is fun. Mm-hmm. At the end of the day, children who are 5, they're motivated by what they enjoy doing.
Like, you're saying fun by trying something new?
Yes. So when they try something new, so when she probably put her children into the gymnastic classes, mm-hmm. it was probably something new, something fun, something that they were motivated to go because it was quite fun, basically. Mm-hmm. That's usually a motivation. Children don't have other source of motivation mm-hmm. than pure fun or being with their friends around or a particular reward at the end, basically, that involves something to do with fun or something to do with good food, etc. They probably haven't thought about it very carefully about the positive reasons of why we should be going gymnastics. So I mention this point because sometimes what happens is that parents, they try to rationalize with their children, you know, gymnastics is a very good sport and this will happen and this benefit and that benefit, which works for adults, but it doesn't work with children. So this is very important. So we need to find out exactly what has happened that a child, after a couple of months, suddenly loses motivation.
Yeah, like as a mother says herself, that not necessarily that something must have happened. Like all of a sudden, they just lost interest.
Maybe she doesn't know, but we need to find out what leads to a lack of motivation. So the first point I'd like to mention is that this is sometimes normal.
Yeah.
Okay, and it happens to children all the time. It happens to adults quite frequently as well, where you do something particularly quite motivated a lot, and after some time you lose motivation, right? In adults, this is mainly because we haven't thought about carefully the reason why we do certain things. So whenever we get involved in a particular action or take a particular decision or something that's going to impact our life, for example, because the reason and the goal behind it is not so clear for us, it's possible that after a couple of weeks or months, we lose motivation.
Thanks so much, Brother McDowell. It's time for a short break. So, dear audience, please stay with us. We'll be right back after a short break.
Please, stop! I got a better game!
IRIB English Radio presents a priceless gift to parents. Do you have problem with your kids?
I have 2 boys. One is 5-year-old and the other one is 3.5. And they constantly fight and wrestle with each other, and it often gets to a dangerous stage.
My 18-month-old daughter has learned to eat by herself, and she just refuses that I feed her. But usually, all the food basically goes everywhere except her mouth. So how can we allow this strife to happen for the purpose of freedom?
Don't worry. We're here to help.
For a child, the purpose of the food is only to feed. It's also for him to learn. It's also for him to explore and fulfill the need of curiosity, fulfill the need of freedom.
Islamic upbringing. Contact us. EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
So welcome back, dear audience. You're listening to Islamic Upbringing from IRIB English Radio. And we are talking about children going to gymnastic and they're losing their interest. And we are having Brother McDowell with us. So Brother McDowell, please continue.
So this was for adults. As for children, again, this happens all the time in children. I mean, one of the complaints that parents have, for example, is that you buy a child a toy and then suddenly after a few weeks of playing that toy, they just completely forget about that toy, right? They lose motivation to play with the toy. And same thing with different sports and different activities and different things they do. It's very normal for children to go through different phases.
Mm-hmm.
So this could be one of those, and it's completely natural for that to happen.
Yeah.
A practical advice is that you tell children to carry on.
So is it like the, it's not the problem from the thing itself, it's just like lack of interest, they just lose interest in the thing.
Which is quite a normal thing. Yeah. For
like beat anything, it might be any toy or it might be any activity.
Yeah. So in this sense, as they lose motivation to gymnastics,
yeah.
I would practically suggest that the beginning is to, with a little bit of push, encourage them to carry on, even though they don't like it or they don't feel motivated towards it. You see, one of the things that we want to teach children slowly, slowly is to realize that sometimes you make a commitment to something.
Yeah, that's right.
So, for example, in this class, it's probably you've paid for a monthly subscription or a year subscription, and you can't just give up halfway through or at the beginning. So you teach children that when you make commitment, you carry on. Or you teach children that sometimes that you don't enjoy doing things sometimes, but there are some benefits to it, and you need to carry on. And then we can't be always be pushed by fun and just trying out different things here and there without sticking and committing towards something.
Yeah.
There's this concept or this trait that we all want to achieve, which is called perseverance, right? I mean, it's something that Islam talks about a lot. It's something that is related to our spiritual progress as well a lot. In the Quran, for example, the angels come down to those who persevere on the path to Allah. So perseverance is something very important. You want to teach children. So a practical advice is not just to give up every time the child wants to give up or stop every time the child doesn't have any motivation anymore, especially when it involves commitment, especially involves something that you've taken seriously and you've made your mind that you're going to achieve some level of that thing, some level of progress in that, such as gymnastics. So you've committed to at least fulfill a class or a particular sequence, a particular course, then you need to teach children that we need to carry on despite the fact that we might not be motivated at the moment. But inshallah, the motivation will come back and we'll find something that will give us pleasure and will make it fun again.
So yeah, over here, like keeping the question in mind, the mother says that the children are 5 and 7. So how do you think that these little children, how can they be motivated?
Perhaps it might be a bit difficult for the 5-year-old, so do go gentle on the 5-year-old. At 5, you're not necessarily going to understand what perseverance is and those kind of things. But through other means, you can, for example, encourage through even sometimes a reward, for example. Obviously, tackle it in a way that you don't have to use the same reward every single time, and then you have to increase the reward, and then you'll it's going to be... In a black hole, basically. It's never gonna stop. But you need to find basically a way to encourage the child, even the younger one, to keep going, or at least promise him that try it for another week, try it for another 2 weeks, try it for another 3 weeks, and then if really you want to stop, then we can find a reason to stop. But give him that push. That it shouldn't be the case that the moment he comes home and says, "I'm done, I don't want to do anymore," we accept it. It shouldn't be that case, especially when you've committed to something.
Thank you so much, Brother Meghdad, and dear audience, we'll be right back after a short break. Do not go anywhere.
The Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam said, "He who has a child must treat him in a childish manner."
Welcome back to your audience. You're listening to Islamic Upbringing from IRIB English Radio. And we have Brother Meghdad with us. And we were discussing how children lose their interest in some activities, how we need to motivate them. So, Brother Meghdad, please continue.
Now, let me mention over here a very important point as well. That we said fun is a very important aspect. So, one of the things you need to find out is, has the level of fun changed, right? And when they're going gymnastics, at the beginning it was new, it was fun, it was really nice. Has it happened over the few months, the fun aspect has gone down, okay? And if it has, then maybe we need to find out a way that brings out the fun again. Even if it's just traveling there and back, for example, or the activities that we do around the gymnastics.
Yeah.
Or maybe speak to the teacher and find out, is it possible to make the class a bit more fun, especially for the younger ones? That's one aspect. I'd like to add to this that Another motivation, I alluded to it, I want to expand a bit more, is reward.
Yeah.
Now, reward can be physical, it can be gifts and that kind of stuff. But very often, one of the motivation factors is a sense of achievement.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of a self-reward, basically, mm-hmm. where you feel you've gained something, you feel mm-hmm. you've achieved something.
Mm-hmm.
The sense of achievement, the sense of growth, the sense of progress mm-hmm. is also a motivation.
Mm-hmm.
And children carry on doing things when they see that they're actually learning new things.
Yeah.
They're actually different when they came out, when they yeah. came into the class from outside the class, mm-hmm. right? They've got new tricks to come and
yeah.
show at home, new moves from gymnastics that they can
mm-hmm.
do now that they couldn't do previously.
Yeah.
Before they went to gymnastics, they could hardly do a particular gymnastics move, but now they can do it really well.
Mm-hmm.
So this sense of progress and achievement
mm-hmm.
is something that motivates a child.
Yeah.
So now there's two things over here. It's possible that this sense of achievement hasn't been there
yeah.
for them over the past few days or
yeah.
past few sessions, and this is why they've lost motivation.
Yeah.
Or it's possible that parents haven't noticed that,
mm-hmm.
right? They haven't given importance to this, and the teacher hasn't noticed that, or the teacher hasn't given importance to that. And therefore, the child, although he might have progressed,
yeah.
but he hasn't noticed it.
Mm-hmm.
He hasn't been given attention to it. And therefore, that has led them to one of the motivation factors to be removed. So one of the things practically we can do is find out, are they progressing, number
yeah.
one? Are they feeling a sense of achievement?
Mm-hmm.
And if there is a sense of achievement, then can we highlight that sense of achievement
mm-hmm.
so that they can feel that they're growing? And through that, slowly, the motivation would come back.
Is it like, you know, they don't see any achievement, so they just lose interest in it?
Exactly.
They don't, feel that it's beneficial anymore?
That's correct.
So thank you so much, Brother McDuff, for joining us. And dear audience, will continue this question in the next show. So thank you for joining us on the program. And if you have any questions, comments, or suggestions, please contact us at our email, englishradio@irib.ir. And visit us at our website, parstoday.com. Until another program, fi amanullah.
Islam solves all of its problems. Allah leaves no stone unturned. Perfect with no flaws at all are the laws of Allah. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 49 meters, 7,300 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. We'll be right back.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.